some of you had lab yesterday, right? Did you de-stress somehow last night from it all? Right? And for those on Wednesday, what could the Monday group tell the Wednesday group what to experience?
Be patient.
Be patient. There you go. And what can you add to your resume after lab?
Calibrate
the amplifier. Make it to zero before you start, right? And then what else are you going to add to your resume that you can now do very well? Change electrodes, microelectrodes, right? So Wednesday group is Wednesday group. You still got a Wednesday group, okay? So you're going to be, you know, kind of what to expect, right? A lot of electrode changing, stabbing muscle cells, patient, breathe in, breathe out. Just kind of, you know, relax. Because that's part of it. But you're going to have some interesting time to learn, you know, how to stab a cell, right? And getting resting membrane potential. And these are relatively big preparations. These are muscle cells. They're big, right? Compared to tiny little neurons that could be in a culture dish that's only 10 microns, you know, size. So it makes you kind of think about what goes on in the literature, what you're reading about, and how they're going about collecting data. So I think that's really a useful point as well. Here, I can put these links down. There you go. Is that better for you? So, you know, have patience with Wednesday lab for those people that are in there. And then the quiz isn't too hard, right? Your quizzes for the class, is it okay? If you read over the material, the protocols, you're okay? And then I inundated you over the weekend, right? Probably put me on spam block by now, I'm sure. But if not, you probably will by the end of the semester. But what I try to do is to give you a lot of information, right, that you can use for your lab write-ups and other things. Yes?
Is it possible for you to post the answers to the quiz after the deadline passes? Because it doesn't tell us, like, what we
know. Okay, I'll have to check with Dr. Danley on that, but she runs the lab. I just go in, I kind of give her total freedom for the lab, and I just go in there and enhance, you know, to help you with you stabbing your cells or whatever you need to do. But I let her take the domain for the lab. So we can ask her about that and see what she'll go for. Because that's her domain. I try not to overstep my bounds. Okay, so, and I sent you over the weekend, if you want to, you don't have to, but, you know, I created like a Facebook page for the class. And why we did that, and you don't have to use your personal Facebook, you know, just a word to the wise, if you do have a personal Facebook that you like, remember, like, some schools or professional programs, they actually will say, here, let me have your phone and go on, log on Facebook, right? And they see if you're, like, dancing naked on top of a bar table somewhere, right? That's not cool, and they'll fire you or not hire you, right? But what you can do is create two Facebook pages. I learned early on that's what my kids did, and I only got, you know, friends on one of them. So what you can do is you can create a professional Facebook page and then your friend Facebook page. So those are good things to think about later on in life, too. So I just created one for the class. You can free emails, right, with Google, and you make a free email, and then you have a professional web, you know, Facebook page that you could use to show your nerdiness, you know, and invite your parents so they realize where their money's going. You know, it's really cool. Post pictures from your lab. Oh, if you don't know, in your lab, you can actually put your iPhone or your other phone, whatever you have, right up to the eyepiece on the microscope and kind of go back and forth, follow the little light that's there, and you can take nice pictures of your preparation, right? And there's two preps I'm going to show you. Oh, I should do that today, maybe. Two preps. One was a muscle that was all degenerated and all just broken all up, and that's when you break your electrode and the KCL spills all over your prep. I don't want to embarrass anybody who was ever prep that was. But that is a destroyed prep, and you won't be able to get any resting membrane potentials from it. And then the other prep, where you see nice muscles, still very clear, not all white, then those are healthy muscles. Maybe for those on Monday that already did that lab, and for those on Wednesday, when you get to the 100 millimolar potassium that's in your saline, you'll start to see your muscles turn white, and then you know that they're dead, and that's kind of like, oh, what happened when you broke your electrode and all the KCL spilled all over? So those will have a poor resting membrane potential. So people have asked in the lab on Monday, you know, why is it that my data is not the same as the next setup or what's being projected up on the board? Why might one group have a different resting membrane potential that's starting off compared to another group? Any ideas? Why might one group have say, a minus 60, another group a minus 50.
Different animals.
And that's a really good point. Some of them are in a molt cycle. I've actually saw that the telson, you can see a little granulation on the telson, and they're molting. So we'll talk about molting later on. But they actually shed their exoskeleton, and their muscles degenerate a little bit while they're molting. And the hormones are different, and so that can have an effect. Any other ideas? How about the dissection process? Somebody dissects, tears off, and there's these big chunks of leftover muscle on there. And what's happening with those big chunks of muscle? What are they spilling out? What's higher inside, ionically? Potassium. So all that muscle spilling out, potassium over into your prep, right on top of the muscle cells that you're trying to stab. And what's the experiment whole protocol that we're looking at? The effects of potassium on the resting membrane potential. So one prep might have a lot of damaged muscle, and the other prep might be pretty clean when you dissected it. So you might get these differences too. So there's lots of variation that you can have from setup to setup, right, in this kind of situation. But in a lab experiment where you're going to do experiments and collect data, you'd be real careful, remove all the dead muscle, make sure you only have healthy muscle, and then wash it all out, and then do a clean experiment. But this really exposes you to what you can do to measure resting membrane potentials. Okay, so hopefully that helps a little bit with the lab. And something else I wanted to show you, just remind you what's coming up down the line. We might move this little quiz up a little bit to maybe the 6th or something, but we might have two quizzes before the exam, all right, just to get you on the right page. Okay, and something else, I think I emailed you some web links last time. This is, if you go to the 350, so this is our bio 350 class lecture page, but at the very top there is this link to the bio 350 web page, lab page, but everything Dr. Danley is doing is putting it on to Canvas, right? So you download Canvas. I just want to show you this other link. When I first created these wet labs back in 2011, I took some undergraduates, and we spent the summer, my wonderful summer, videoing all the labs. Now, the labs have changed since 2011, but at that time, we had like 12 labs. You only got 8 now, right? So we really, whipped y'all in shape the first year. I was a little bit overzealous, and we had like 3 lab reports. We had to do full papers, and the students were sweating it out and complaints left and right. I just was so excited with physiology, but they have the rest of the classes to deal with. But if you go down to that link that I just showed you back from 2011, scroll on down. These were the TAs back then. You will see these labs here, like this one here, for example, biological membranes. This is the one I sent you, I think it was, maybe, whatever. This was a model circuit where you actually had to build it on breadboard. Sorry. There's another one here. Where is it? Oh, the RP page. So if you look at that, I think I sent you this one. There are videos for many of these labs that we made with the students that were in here. And we actually publish these labs in peer-reviewed journals, so other people around the world are using them. And so that's through JOVE, a Journal of Visualized Experimentation. But you got write-ups of the protocols. But what's really nice for you is that you have some references down here that you can use for your write-ups or just if you want more information. So most of the labs, except for some of them that are now changed, but you have a lab looking at neuromuscular junction, for example, or maybe human EKG and human breathing. So we put this up there. You'll have some, respiratory diseases, some protocols, some ideas that we'll get to later on that you'll have to know about. So that might be a good resource for you as well. All right. And the Facebook is basically for you to interact among yourselves, right? So if you have a question about something, you could post it on, because most people are talking to everybody, that they use Facebook more than they would on Canvas with having their app ready. So if you have a question about something, what was it that he said in lecture? I'm confused about this. He talks too fast. Then you could post that really quickly. I'm not offended, believe me. But the Facebook gets you an answer really quick among your colleagues, right? And so you could do that if you want to. Some classes do that on campus. There's a statistics course that has everybody on a Facebook page so they can ask questions to each other. So that might help as well. All right. So, and then there's always fun things that you want to do, like look up stuff about physiology in all your spare time, right? Really cool stuff. Like, we'll get into cardiovascular systems, but these little fun facts are kind of fun. Look at this just to kind of get on there. Your heart, which is really amazing. in your kidneys, processing over 50 gallons of blood every day. Isn't that amazing? 50 gallons. Think of a gallon of milk going through your kidney. 50 gallons of that going right through your kidney every day. So when you have kidney damage, what's going to happen? You got some problem, right, filtering that fluid. And you only make, you know, a little bit of about 1.8 liters of urine a day. You're going to get to that when you go to the urine lab. But if you have kidney damage, think you could be having some problems. But how does this fit in with today's talk? It's not a total tangent. You might think it is. Ion balance, right? If you lose too much sodium, you lose potassium, right? That's a problem for your electrolytes. And that's going to affect your nervous system, your resting membrane potentials, and how your body functions. So kidneys are very important. We'll come to that. I'm just trying to pull it all together so you can relate it. Now let's hope this microphone's working. I hope it is. So we left off. I'm talking about bioelectricity, right? And into the labs that you're working with today. And remember, back a long time ago, when they first described bioelectricity, Galvani did this work that was really neat. I told you about before, with dissimilar metals and the touching them together, and then could cause an electric spark, basically. You know, activate that nerve like in D. That nerve then could fire that muscle. Electrical conduction, the muscle contracts, but you generate electricity with your muscle. And then that could activate another nerve and stimulate the other muscle. So really neat experiments. That's really the father of bioelectricity. And when you think about it, you know, you've seen EEGs, right? They put them on the head. They put EKGs across your chest, and you can record the electrical activity of your heart. How is it that electrical activity is being recorded? What's generating it? For example, your EEG or your EKG, what generates that electricity? What we're talking about generally. Yeah. Pardon? Action potential. What's generating the action potential?
Ion flux.
Ion flux, right? Charged ion flux. A sodium ion, +1, a calcium, +2, a chloride, -1. I've heard some people talking about, in the lab, they were saying chlorine ions. Chloride, right? Chloride. Cl2, gas, chlorine, the chloride ions. So when you get a charged movement from one place to another, that means electrical difference, right? A potential difference. That's what you pick up with an EEG. That's what you pick up with an EKG or an EMG, electromyogram. It's all about ion movement, right? And then you can relate that ion movement to how that tissue's functioning, right? Put an EEG on, and there's no activity, there's a problem, right? So, you know, good things to think about. So bioelectricity, really important. And if you think about it, what they're developing nowadays, they're actually trying to harvest bioelectricity. The Army is actually doing this too, to put leads and try to record the electrical activity, like in muscles, and actually be able to charge up your cell phone. But there was a kid that came up with something that was just phenomenal, and he got a patent, I think millions of bucks. He decided he was thinking about movement and making electricity. Because anytime you kind of move something, right, you could generate electricity, like the windmill or, you know, the fans that you see for wind energy. So he devised some shoe that every time that you walk, you're pushing down on something, right? So that movement, and it would actually generate electricity. So he could have this little generator that generate and put it into a battery, and you could tie the battery to your shoelaces, and so you could actually, the Army paid him, I think, a couple million bucks for his patent, and then you could be walking around generating electricity, store it to the battery, and then you could charge up your cell phone. So you could be way out in the middle of nowhere, maybe those satellite phones, and still then get energy from your phone. You've seen those flashlights you can shake, right, that doesn't have a battery, but it's by that wire that wraps around the magnetic coil, and you can generate electricity. Something similar like that. Okay, so that's pretty cool if you think about it. Some of the amazing things that people develop, and you think, it's just phenomenal. Well, while we're on this tangent, I know this is definitely a tangent, but it does talk about CO2. Okay, so we did talk about CO2 before. This kid in New York on a science fair project, he was wondering, why is it that mosquitoes, you know, come around you, right? Or ticks. Anybody have an idea? Why do ticks, like if you walk underneath a tree, ticks fall on you? I know we don't have a tick problem out here, but you do sometimes in the summer when you go hiking under a gorge, you got to check for ticks, you know. That's why I shave my head. I'm just making sure you're looking. Okay, so, but why is it mosquitoes might attack you?
Doesn't it depend on how much CO2 you release and then like, your cholesterol, too?
It could be the cholesterol you're mentioning and the CO2. So they are attracted to CO2, right? So that's pretty amazing. And so they can be attracted to animals. Why? Because when you breathe, you make CO2, comes out, right? And where's that CO2 coming from? What's the rationale for it? Where's the CO2 produced?
At the end of cellular respiration.
Yes, at the electron at the end, you know, throughout your electron transport chain, the byproducts of cellular metabolism. So then basically any animals that are making CO2 attracted to, right? So this kid in New York came up with a really good science fair project. He said, you know those little bug zappers with the little wires, and when a fly comes in and gets zapped because there's electricity across there? So he said, well, why can't we just really attract mosquitoes, because he hated mosquitoes, and he had a little CO2 cartridge in the middle that would puff out little bits of CO2, and it would attract mosquitoes in there, and they get zapped. Patented it. He could retire, didn't have to go to college, right? Multi-million-dollar patent. So pretty neat, and now that's marketed all over the place. So just little things like that, if you know about animals and you know what you could do, you can really be creative. So anyways, the CO2, there was a part for this tangent. Okay, it's not total tangent. But ticks and mosquitoes. But then did you take genetics? Some of you took genetics? How did you knock your flies out? CO2, so it knocked them out, right? Caused them to be, you know, anesthetized, basically. So a little bit of CO2 is an attractant to insects. But too much CO2 actually makes them pass out. Now, why does it make them pass out? Any idea? pH balance, maybe?
They need oxygen.
They need oxygen also. So I had a, this is a tangent somewhat, but it's all fitting. So I used to teach 152. I hated it. Yes, it's on the mic. I hated it. Because 350 students in the class. But there was this kid that was sitting in the front row. Not like you all, okay? But he would ask a question every day, right? And in the 152, there's 350 students, and you just have to, you know, chop, 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 get through lectures, right? Because you got all this content. And he would ask questions every day, slow me down. I think it was paid off by the other students. But then, and he had a really interesting accent, and then he wanted to work in the lab. And here he was, a freshman. And so I said, well, okay, since you're so into physiology. And then he came to the lab, and we were working with Drosophila at the time. And then he asked that simple question. What is it that's knocking them out with CO2? Because it was the first time he worked with fruit flies, too. And, you know, I said, I don't really know. Let's look at it. And so I thought pH right off the bat. So you could put CO2, and you know your flies just flop down. Your little larvae, if you're looking at the maggots, they'll just stop moving. But they become totally flaccid. They just relax completely. There's maggot stretched out, like on a hammock, you know. And then, so we went upstairs and we talked to some geneticists that were in the building at the time. They used to have three geneticists. How is CO2 working to knock these flies out? Because you take the CO2 away and they wake up really quick, right? And we know that's a problem with, you know, you with too much CO2. And I thought pH. And they said, well, maybe it's, you know, blocking the mitochondria. But how does low pH make you not move, right? If it's for you, your heart stops working and you pass out. And you come back after you can respire again. But if you have too much of that, then you're dead, right? So, but the flies get back up pretty quick after you take that gas off. And you're leaving them too long, like hours, they will die. So we thought, people didn't know. They said, oh, maybe it blocks mitochondria. Maybe it is just the anoxia, low oxygen. Maybe it's something else, you know. So we decided, well, let's give it a shot. So we took pure nitrogen. And insects are supposed to be pretty good about low oxygen. Anoxia. So we took pure nitrogen, flooded the tanks with pure nitrogen so there's no oxygen in there, and they were still moving around pretty well. And the larvae were still kind of crawling around. Amazing. But if you did that with CO2, they would have been knocked out really quick. So it wasn't the anoxia. What else could it be? This low pH protected, maybe. So we dissected flies open, a little larvae, a little maggots, you can dissect them open, and you can record. If they become flaccid, then you think, oh, is it the muscle or is it the nerve to the muscle? What is it, you know, that's causing this flaccid movement, right? So where's the mechanism of action? Always think mechanism of action. So what did the student do? We opened up the flies, stabbed the muscle fiber with an intracellular electrode, stimulate the nerve, and you can get synaptic transmission, all right, and saline. Take saline, bubble it with CO2, yes, the pH drops to 5. Goes from 7.4 to 5. Okay. So let's take, it might be the pH. So let's take saline and get it down to 5 with HCl, hydrochloric acid. So you drop the pH to 5, put that on your preparation, and you still get synaptic transmission. Okay. Now we take saline, put CO2 in there, the pH goes to 5, put that on your preparation, stops right away. What's the difference? It can't be the pH then, right? It can't be the pH of the saline extracellular. So there's something neat about CO2 itself. Now, we know that if you put a high pH outside a cell, that doesn't mean necessarily the pH inside the cell is 5. So now we have a question. We've got to scratch our heads, right? What's inside the cell that can convert CO2 to a low pH quickly? What's the enzyme? Test question. Abbreviation CA. Carbonic anhydrase, right? So inside the cells, mostly of all your cells, you probably have that are living, carbonic anhydrase. So maybe the CO2 goes inside and converts it to bicarb and hydrogen ion really quick, right? Because carbonic anhydrase is a very fast enzyme, 1 times 10 to the 6, a million times faster for that reaction when you have carbonic anhydrase. So maybe it's a little pH inside the cell. So what you can do is you can take another compound called acetoacetate, and it's an acidic solution. You can put that on your saline, and it'll drop it to 5, and it'll go right across bilipid membranes. So now we can put that on our preparation, put it inside on the prep, and guess what happens to synaptic transmission? It still happens. Wow. What on earth is going on? It's not the low pH. There's something about the CO2 itself. So this was really exciting. I said, well, Nick, and he was quite interested in this. He originally came from Syria and then went to Paris, France, and went to a high school, international school for in English in Paris, and then came here to UK because his uncle was actually across the street in the clinical field, and he was going to stay with his relatives and then go to UK. All right, so I said, well, Nick, this is really neat. Why don't we write this up? So we submitted it to a journal, and the editor said, this is so cool, send it out to reviewers, and within a week it was published, basically. So it was really neat. And we basically found out that CO2 somehow is blocking the glutamate receptor, because at the neuromuscular junction in insects and in most invertebrates, not all, but most, like your crayfish, the transmitter is glutamate at the neuromuscular junction, not acetylcholine like you. It's glutamate. But somehow, we think that CO2 is actually blocking the pore. This is an ionic channel, that CO2 might be blocking that pore, so glutamate can't work on it. So how can we test this? So Nick came up with a really good idea. He said, let's just stab our prep. Let's put glutamate on. What happens when you put glutamate on your prep? It depolarizes. Then these receptors, as we're going to talk about, desensitize, and it comes back down to rest. But if we put CO2 on first, our saline with CO2, and then put glutamate, we get no change. So therefore, it became insensitive to glutamate. So that's pretty cool. And then we decided to do that in your favorite preparation, which is crayfish. And then the same thing happens on that preparation. So then he published another paper. He went into UK med school, then he went to UC San Diego for psychiatry, and that's the number one place in neuroscience in the country, actually. And then he's now a practicing psychiatrist. He probably was trying to work on my brain, but anyway.
What did you say about carbonic anhydrase?
It's the fastest enzyme to really convert CO2 plus water goes to what?
Carbonic.
Bicarbonate and hydrogen ion, right? Great stuff. Okay, so that was a tangent, but you get the idea, right? It was kind of neat. He worked it all the way through. Really an interesting project. And then made some good progress with that. So, and then understanding some of the mechanisms of action. Probably why your insects drop out really quickly and then can come back really quickly, because CO2 can be exchanged very fast, right? So it's pretty neat to think about. Then he was so interested in his write-up, he was looking about, you know, anesthetics. And guess how they used to do surgery in people a long time ago? So he actually went and found old references. We couldn't get the papers in the library. We even wrote to the NIH and tried to get some of those papers, and we couldn't get it. But then they said we had it on microfilm. So we got the microfilm in. These are really old papers, right? Written in French. And it was from Paris, so he was all excited because he studied in Paris. And guess what? The original surgeries were done for people. You want to do something, and maybe they're having stomach pains or whatever, they cut them open, they didn't have x-rays and all that stuff back then. Guess how they did the surgeries a long time ago? They put a paper bag, basically, over their head. And they would let them breathe in and out until what? The CO2 builds up, and you pass out. They can cut you open, do a surgery, if they start to wake up, put it back over their head until they pass out again. And so that was pretty neat. So he was very excited by this, you know, finding out the original work and then referencing it. And then we had a crazy reviewer on the paper said, why are you referencing these old work that nobody can get? It's kind of neat, that's the original, you know, work about CO2 and the effects of your nervous system making you pass out. But that case is really a pH. There are some papers, we'll get to this, about CO2 working on glutamate receptors in your brain. It works on the NMDA receptor in your brain. It actually makes it sensitive, less sensitive to glutamate too. So even in our brain, our glutamate receptors can be less sensitive if CO2 is around. And they think it's really from the pH binding on some of the proteins that are on there, the amino acids. Okay, so a tangent, but you see how it's all related. I'm not going to test you in all the little details, but we should know the big picture of things. Okay, so pretty neat. Bioelectricity is really very cool when you think about the history of it and how it was described in the 1700s. And if you look on some of these PowerPoints that you download, I have sometimes text underneath the PowerPoints. You know how to look at that, right? So look at the in there, and you might see some text that's in there that might help you out. All right, this thing's not functioning. There we go. Now it's functioning. All right, so it's like your lab. Wonderful lab. Intercellular recordings, yay. Just want to get up and get going. Wednesday's group, just you'll get out of bed, just hopping, ready to go to lab. Don't come too early. They won't let you in. You can't get started early. Well, be so excited to do it. But when you start off, the way that they started these early recordings was that you always had a reference to the saline on the outside, right? So that's your ground wire in your experiments. And then your intercellular electrode. Remember, it wasn't until the 1950s, really the late 1950s, that intracellular electrodes were even made with glass. It was actually a group up in Chicago that came up with that. Before, it was just a wire that you could only, say, put inside of squid axons or very large cells. But, you know, what would happen if you put a big old wire through the cell? Right? But a squid axon, you could do that because you could tie off the two ends and wrap it really tight and have the wire inside. So the squid axon was just one of those August Crowe principles, right? Really a good model. But when they just first made intracellular electrodes with glass electrodes, then you could stab across the bioelectric membrane, have all the problems with resistance and filling them and all that good stuff. Side note, you all are really complaining about maybe filling the electrodes and changing them all out. My job as a sophomore in college, Texas Tech, I had a part-time job. Guess what my job was? Getting up around 4 o'clock a.m. and going to a lab over in the physiology department to do what? Fill electrodes. Just what you were doing. 4 a.m. Think how loud that is. All right. Filling electrodes with KCL, and they wouldn't fill. And then you would test them. You'd put a little wire in it, you'd put in some saline solution, and you'd pass current across it and see their resistance. Most of them, more than 50%, were no good. So you'd throw them away. Why was it so bad back then? And we did weird things. I mean, really weird things. Just think about this. Really weird things to try to get the fluid to go to the very tip. We would put that in a humidity box and have high humidity, trying to keep the moisture to go down there. We'd put them on a centrifuge, these flat ones that you might remember, the old capillaries that you take blood out and spin it around like that. You'd seal off one end, you know, like a little bit, and try to force it down to the tip. You know, spinning it around. Crazy stuff like that. And that's what I did at like 4 to 6 a.m. in the morning, right? Paid for my sophomore year, one semester of college. Crazy stuff. Realized, I'm surprised I didn't quit science right there. Just quit. Well, they become an engineer or something. But then, later on, about my senior year in college, that, you know, I still talked to that person that made me do that stuff, but, you know, I did pay for bills. But later on, somebody came up with a clever idea, which you are taking advantage of right now. What they came up with is, let's not just have this capillary that you pull and make it really thin. Let's do something that would help fill the solution to the tip. What do you think they did? That's different than the electrodes you're using today from what I had to use when I was a sophomore for this lab. And the lab I was working in was stabbing cardiac cells in rabbits to try to understand your cardiac potential and trying out new drugs. That's another tangent I won't get into right now. But anyways, what do you think they did differently with that capillary? That glass tube? Any ideas? The guy's probably a millionaire whoever described this thing. Creativity is really important, right? Science breakthroughs, medical breakthroughs with creativity. Well, he thought capillary action. So how could we get that to go down the capillary action? So what he described, he went to a company, this guy, and actually said, can we get a very, very fine little glass rod that's so small that we could put inside of these capillaries, heat it up just a little bit so it anneals to one side of the glass, you know, on one side, and then when you pull it, what happens? You have a little rod that goes all the way down to the tip. So now when you fill it, capillary action just kind of travels down that little rod and right to the tip, pretty much to the tip. Some of your electrodes didn't fill. That put a lot of undergraduates out of work, you know, but maybe better. They don't have to get up early to fill electrodes. But so now they call that an omega dot. So because if you took a cross section through that capillary, what does it look like? It looks like a circle with a little omega at the bottom, you know, if you have it at the bottom, right? Because that's that glass rod that's down at the bottom. So that's called an omega dot filled capillary tube. And that's what you're using now. So you see these breakthroughs make it easier for you to do experiments, make it easier for researchers to do experiments. But you think of these people a long time ago, and I went to a group in Czechoslovakia and Prague, a little bit outside of Prague one time to give a seminar. And this guy, he was doing electrophysiology on neurons, and his wife worked in the lab. So this is back in 1990, all right? I know, you know, we're born embryo somewhere or something. All right, or haploids out there. So he was actually, his wife was actually pulling electrodes over a glass flame by hand. And she was so good at it that she could pull these glass electrodes. They didn't have these pullers. The puller that I was using to pull your electrodes, that's a $6,000 puller. Has a platinum filament on it, pulls the electrodes pretty consistently. That's, you know, pretty expensive. But there, she was actually pulling all the glass electrodes over a flame for the lab to use. And I'm thinking, I'm sure not going to complain about my sophomore year in college filling electrodes. They were still pulling them over a flame. But he was actually publishing fantastic papers and really good stuff. Just makes you think about, you know, people being creative and being able to do things. So it's pretty neat. I know, lots of tangents. Okay. But you get the idea of where science progresses, like the bioelectricity, right? Progression and understanding this. So when you stab it in the cell, you should have had a good RP, right? But some cells are different. Every cell's a little bit different with the RP. You know, we told you about that. But generally, your muscle cells, probably minus 50, minus 60. Sometimes you might have had a little higher values or lower, depending on if you spilled out solution. So this is to kind of pull these concepts together, and I know some of you might remember this from 152. But let's say these diagrams are sometimes a little confusing, just to get your head around it. So what they're doing here is injecting current, nanoamps, current, injecting current into the cell through your electrode. Okay? So you inject negative current here, and you see the potential. So that's a voltage up there. That's the membrane voltage. The little M on the V means membrane voltage. So they're measuring that potential. So you see, like number two, there it hyperpolarizes. Anytime it goes below resting membrane potential, that's hyperpolarization. So it's hyperpolarized. Give more negative current, more hyperpolarization. Give depolarizing current, 3, and it goes up. Give some more, then all of a sudden it reaches a special potential we call the threshold potential and fired an action potential. Now, not all cells fire action potentials, right? Not all cells fire action potentials. If it's going to conduct electricity a long distance, like your nerves or maybe your muscle, then you need an action potential to get that electricity to travel, right? The other potentials that are non-action potential, those are just called graded potentials. They're graded, all right? So we're going to talk more about that as we go along. You have many, and why is it that, what's so unique about the threshold potential? What channels are opening up generally? Voltage gated? Sodium channels. Great. Question.
So did you
boom. All those voltage-gated sodium channels recognize that voltage, and then they all just open up. Da, 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 da. You know, they're all open up. I've got to give you sound effects. They open up, and then a lot of sodium rushes in, and then depolarize, okay? Many different types of ion channels. This table just gives you a kind of an idea of channels. I don't want you to memorize them all, but you get the idea. There's a, here you see these differences, like a voltage-gated calcium channel, a voltage-gated potassium channel, delayed rectifier, means it's delayed in opening, not right away. Here's a calcium-dependent potassium channel. Isn't that wild? So calcium comes in the cell and then causes a potassium channel to open. That's kind of wild because calcium is generally low inside the cell. But as soon as calcium comes in, potassium channel opens. That's unique. And then you see up there at the top the leak potassium channel. That's the primary leak channel that's in the membranes that you're testing in that lab, for example. Because if you raise potassium and it's leaky, then potassium can go into the cell, right? Or maybe even out of the cell, depending on what you're looking at. So the leak channels, we have to think about, generally, they call it a potassium channel, but leak channels kind of fit a general classification with monovalent, single ion charge, monovalent cationic channels. Now, what does that mean? Monovalent, you know, one, cationic plus charge, right? So what do we kind of think about when we think of that? Sodium and potassium, generally, right? So these leak channels really are, they're leaky to sodium and they're leaky to potassium. Mostly potassium, but if potassium's not around, sodium can leak. Okay, so it's really kind of a trade-off for that. Now we're going to talk more about that in a minute. All right, when you describe biological membranes, this is confusing sometimes. After 22 years of teaching, this is where it still gets confusing for students sometimes. So the membrane, the channels that we're talking about act like resistors. All right. Now your leak channel is leaking all the time. So it has some resistance, right? But not really too much. So it's got some resistance. And we refer to it in a physics terms with a resistor. So little squiggles of resistor. If you remember from physics, which you all purged a long time ago, right? It's this little resistor. So the membrane channels act like resistors. Now let's think about the voltage-gated sodium channel. At rest, is it open? No, because it's voltage-gated, right? So that channel's closed. It has really high resistance. This is where the confusion comes in sometimes, right? With people. It's not open at rest. But at a certain voltage, it opens up and becomes an ion channel. So you might see in some textbooks an arrow across the resistor. And I don't know if you cover that in physics or not. Maybe not. The arrow that's across the resistor means it's a variable resistor. So the voltage-gated ion channels are variable resistors. They will open up and allow conductance to go through depending on the conditions, like a particular voltage. This other part over here is a capacitor. So your membrane, the lipid membrane, acts like a capacitor. So what's a capacitor? Does anybody remember from physics what a capacitor is? Holds the charge. Back in the old days, when you had tubes in your TVs, I know, it's like old-fashioned movies, right? That's my generation. All right, you had tubes in your TVs, and sometimes your TV would go out. So instead of calling the electrician, you could actually go buy a tube and replace it. Yeah, that's what happens back then. Okay, but what's the problem? You could unplug it from the wall, your TV, and if anybody has electricians in their family, talk to them. You unplug it from the wall, and you're going to go in there and switch out the tube. You get a shock of your life. You can die from that. And the electrician, what they would do back then is they would take a screwdriver and touch the different objects in there, basically the capacitors that are in there, to discharge them. Because if you touch it, where's that electricity going to go? You discharged it, and it's going through you. So capacitors hold charge. How to think about a capacitor? If you remember from physics, you could actually build up capacitor, and the capacitor is related to what? The surface area, all right? The bigger surface area, more charge. The closeness of these two plates, like if you had two metal plates close together, if this one's negative, what's it going to do to this one? It's going to attract positive here, right? The closer they are together, the more attraction. The bigger the surface area, the more charge, all right? So you don't want to purge your physics, right? It all comes back, it relates. So when you think about the bilipid membrane, really the bilipid membrane doesn't change that much in thickness, right? That's pretty constant. It's the cell surface area that would change. Small cell, big cell, right? So that's the capacitance. And that's important when we talk about having a charge across the membrane, right? Because that's the charge across the membrane. So now if you open up a channel, ions from the outside will be attracted to this negative charge on the inside, right? So that's kind of neat. So sodium's going to come in. But potassium, you know, if it's negative in here, what's this charge doing to potassium? It's kind of holding it in, right? So that's kind of neat. So we have to think about ion movement, not just concentration gradient. That's why we call it the electrochemical gradient. So if you have an open response question, and you just write chemical gradient for, you know, ion movement, you're going to lose half the points because you didn't write electrochemical gradient, right? So that's the rationale with this charge and moving across the membrane. This charge is just on the membrane. So you don't have, the whole cell is not negative inside. It neutralizes inside with other ions and the proteins and stuff. But we're just talking across the membrane. Why are we talking just across the membrane, just that surface area across the membrane? Because that's where your pumps are. And that's where your pumps are pumping out sodium, potassium in, maintaining that charge. If we had a membrane potential like you have in your lab, and you poison the mitochondria, what's going to happen to your resting membrane potential? Let's say it's at minus 50. Minus 50, minus 50. You poison the mitochondria, it's going to start to depolarize, right? And it's going to go to zero, where there's no charge anymore, because the pump needs ATP, right? And if you poison the mitochondria, you can't make ATP, enough of it, to maintain that ionic difference. So your pump is very important for maintaining the resting membrane potentials in your cell. Remember, that's probably the most energy-demanding process in your body, is actually maintaining ionic difference. We talk about the kidney, you know, filtering or pumping, or the heart pumping that much blood, you know, every day. Well, it can only pump because the electrical gradients in your contraction of your skeletal muscle or your heart muscle and allowing those ions to come back to rest so it can contract again, right? So it's all based on really a lot to do with the sodium-potassium pump. Okay, so if we think of a membrane, you could think of it in this resistor and capacitor kind of charge, and what's going to happen if you just start to put electrical current across the cell membrane? First, it's going to build up the capacitor, right? So you get charge on your capacitor, and then if it can go through the resistor, then it can go through the resistor. But it's going to build up charge quickly on your across your membrane, and then depending on the resistor, it can go through or not. It might be a variable resistor. All right. The battery in that case is what? Your sodium potassium pump in your example with the membrane. All right. So when we talk about that charge buildup, when you put a current across the cell, let's say this current injected in, IM, membrane, you inject current, what do you get on your voltage of your membrane? You get this graded response to build up. What is it doing? The capacitor, and then finally going through the ion channel, right? And now you got a membrane potential. So that relates to the VM. And this, we don't do this experiment in here. We do have a course called Neurophysiology, Bio 446. I know that most of you graduate, but if you're just dying to take a great course next semester, in the fall we teach a course just in membrane biophysics, and you actually inject into the cells and look at this kind of graded response. So this is called tau. That rise time is called tau. And that's an international unit that's used to measure the effects of that cell. So if you have a little cell here, let me change this over. Okay, you can see this. If you inject current in here, all right, and you had another electrode, you would measure this graded response coming up like that, right? And tau is the time it takes, that little tau is the time it takes to rise 63% of the maximum response. So if this is 100 millivolts up here, what is the millivolt potential at tau? 63 millivolts, all right? So that would be 63 millivolts. What is tau comprised of? Tau is comprised of your favorite two initials, R times C. Some of you might catch that. All right, R times C. Resistance times capacitance, okay? Resistance times capacitance. So this is the membrane resistance and this is capacitance of the membrane. That equals tau. All right. We're going to see why that's important when we talk about synaptic transmission later on and how that's really very important. Let's say you have a cell with a whole bunch of leak channels in it. Is that going to have a higher membrane resistance or a lower membrane resistance? A whole bunch of leak channels. It has a high density of leak channels. So remember, the channels are the resistance, but if you have more of them, like more holes in this door, more doors in this room, how fast could you go out? So lower membrane resistance. Because if you don't have any, you have a lot of resistance. The more holes you have in, the less resistance. Because if you don't have any channels, there's no doors in this room, you can't get out, right? I'd love to trap you in here for 3 hours of physiology, right? That'd be great. It's like your labs. So if you had a cell with a whole bunch of leak channels, Rm goes down. What's going to happen to tau? It's linear, right? It's going to go down also, right? What does that mean? That means instead of having this, if tau is so small, let's do the first one. You might have like this. So tau was here, and then you converted it to this. So you can see tau has moved quite a bit. It's become less, right, because you've had more leak channels. So that could affect how the cell behaves and how well it might get to threshold, right? And so we're going to talk about that. We're going to rehash it in different ways, okay? So that's important to think about. Let me see what else is happening here. And then we're going to talk about something here in just a second. Okay, so remember, electrochemical gradient, really important. So if you have a difference in concentration, 0.1 molar over here, and a low concentration over here, which way does potassium want to go?
From high to low.
High to low, right? So boom, wants to go this way. How could you keep potassium from moving? What could you do over here with this electrode? Make it positive or make it negative? Make it negative, right? Keep the potassium over here. So how much negativity do we have to put on this electrode to keep the concentration gradient at balance? Okay? That's what you got to think about, right? But what's going to happen if we put a negative charge over here to keep potassium? What's going to happen to the chloride? It's going to want to go. So now we set up a concentration gradient for chloride, and we have this difference for potassium that's being maintained. So this is when we have to think about what's called the Nernst equation. And if you want to look up on Wikipedia, you could do it now if you've got your phone or whatever, you iPhone or Surface or whatever you have. The Nernst equation is really cool. And this is what you did on Monday's lab and you're going to do on Wednesday's lab. But the Nernst equation is another one of those great tattoos that you could get. Much better than the butterflies, believe me. Okay. So what does this Nernst equation mean? LN. Well, let's do this out over N. Okay. So the Nernst equation. And you want to know this. And so this really comes from the gas laws. I know. Physics, chemistry again. Love. What's R? Anybody remember from chemistry?
The gas constant.
This is the gas constant, right? T is in temperature. In what temperature?
Kelvin.
I know you all forgot all that 273.15 things, right? I will not try to do that to you on this test. We will give you numbers already like that. What's Z? Z is the ionic charge of the ion. Like for sodium, that's going to be a plus 1. Calcium, plus 2. Chloride, minus 1, right? F is Faraday's constant. So we've got a constant. We've got a constant. And if your temperature is constant, that's constant, right? And if it's for sodium, you know, 1 plus, that's constant. So we can take all that, change ln to log, and then come up with a particular number that you can use at a particular temperature. Now I took some numbers here. If you do like some experiments for invertebrates, for example, like they did in the squid axon at 18C, that comes out to be 0.058 over Z for the charge, EX. And you can convert that to a log base 10 now. And you could then look at the ions out over N of the cell. at 38 degrees, like your body temperature, for example, E, let's just do it for potassium that you should have already done for your lab, but let's do different types of so let's think about this. So let's do one at 38. And it will give you these kind of numbers on your tests, right? Depending on the temperature, so you don't have to worry about converting centigrade to Kelvin and all that, because that's craziness. All right. So let's think about it. What is maybe a good potassium on the outside of a cell? Let's just make it simple. Maybe 10. Okay. Let's just put it for theoretically. Because on the exam, you're going to get theoretical values, right, to make sure that you can work this out. So I'm warning you ahead of time. So let's say 10. Inside the cell, we know it's high, right? Let's just say this particular cell, it's at 100, all right? Some weird animal we got off Mars or something like this. Okay, so it's 100. So what is 10 over 100, 0.1? What's the log base 10 of 1, or 0.1, right? And on your phones, we have this every year with people. On your phones, you have those little calculators, right? And then people say they can't do log. How do you do log? Turn sideways, right? And now we say we have 0.1 log base 10, and we have a negative 1, right? So if we do negative 1, here, this turns into negative 1. What's our value here? 0.061. Something's beeping. What's beeping? Okay. Maybe it's a record. So, times this negative 1, so that whole thing comes out to be 0.061 negative volts, which then is really 61 millivolts minus 61 millivolts, right? That would be the resting, that would be the equilibrium potential, what we're talking about. That's the equilibrium potential for potassium. All right. That's the amount of electricity or the potential across that membrane due to that concentration difference. Okay? Due to that concentration gradient, this is the potential that will arise. Or you can think of it the other way. If you wanted to give... This thing's acting crazy. I think the battery died on this thing. Anyways, so... Pardon? Z was 1 because it's for potassium, so 1 plus. Right.
Oh, okay.
And so,
what Z represents charge?
Z is the charge of the ion. So now you have this, if you gave that much electrical potential across a membrane that is permeable to potassium, you could generate that concentration gradient. So you can think of it the other way around. But what's the problem with this Nernst equation? Anybody remember from lab?
Constant.
Okay. But I went ahead and converted all that. When you convert the ln and add in R and F, and then you convert the ln to this, then you can actually come up with that value. I just don't want to torture you to have to convert it all. Okay. So, what's the problem with the Nernst equation?
It doesn't take into account permeability.
It doesn't take into account permeability, exactly. So, this assumes like just the leak channels, right? And the leak channels... potassium, this works out pretty well, right, for potassium, because you have potassium leak. I don't know what's happening with this thing, but anyways. Okay, so you don't have potassium, this doesn't take into consideration sodium that much, or calcium, or chloride. So, Bernard Katz, Goldman, Hodgkin came up with another equation called the GHK equation, Goldman, Hodgkin, Katz. Anytime you hear Kat's name, you just kind of like put your hands together, hum, because it's just like he's a god, all right? So he did so many interesting things. So he came up with the GHK equation, Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation, which takes into permeability. Now, the issues with the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation is you have to think about how this works. So this is the ions, RT over ZF. And you can convert it to log if you want to, or whatever it was that you did. You can't see anything? Oh, the glare. Sorry. Okay. There we go. Back to this light. Is the permeability, let's put it for potassium, permeability of potassium, just like you do in your lab, concentration of potassium, out over N, plus the permeability of sodium, plus, and you do want to know this equation. It's one of those things you will have to memorize. And you keep on going. And maybe for calcium. Okay. So now we have, and you can keep on going for different ions. So this is Bowman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. Now what happens every year is that people screw this up and they don't write it right. They, like, when they work it out for their homework problem, they, like, add these two things together. This whole line goes across the whole denominator and numerator, right? So it's divided by. So you have to remember that, because that'll be a mistake that you'll make on your test. And I'm mean, because I give you the wrong answers. When you do it wrong, that'll be on there too, right? So know what you're doing here. And we will give you this number here, but you got to work this out. So what's really interesting with this, there's a little trick to it. Because calcium's 2 plus, and that Z is over here, we can think about this Z is 1, right, for sodium, potassium. But let's cancel out that Z. The problem is calcium's a 2 plus. So people with algebra in your brain, you could think about how to do this. You just put a little half to the power, function on the calcium, okay? And if it's chloride, you might see this in some textbooks, and I had students come back that were in graduate school, and they said, oh, God, Cooper, this Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation doesn't work right. And I think, read your textbook or go to Wikipedia. But anyways, if you did for chloride, because chloride's a minus, just that you're familiar with this, if you did chloride, what are you going to do here for chloride? Because it's a minus 1 over here with that Z, you can flip this over. Now it's N over out, okay? I won't try to trick you for this, but it's just a way of flipping it over so you can keep that equation going. Well, what happens if the cell is not permeable to chloride or calcium or sodium? What does this equation reduce down to? If it's not permeable to chloride, that becomes zero. That means this is zero. That's zero. If it's not permeable to calcium, that's zero. That's zero. That's zero. If it's not permeable to sodium, that's zero. That's zero. If it's only permeable to potassium, P is on top of these. What did we go back to? The Nernst equation, right? So you're back to the Nernst equation. So Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz came up with this. It's really quite cool. And he described the shape of the action potential by doing this with differential equations. So back to your math. That's why you take calculus. Differential equations. We don't have to do that for your exam. We won't do that. Differential equations to describe the upstroke of the action potential. And then somebody was interviewing him, and he was actually doing the permeability of these ions to get the membrane potential at every one of these values after threshold and still going up, because he was looking at ions moving across the squid axon that he had in the dish, and he could play with those ions. So many experiments that were being done for these to work out the shape of the action potential, which we just take relatively for granted today. And somebody interviewed him, and he was doing differential equations, and it took him a year to get the upstroke. And he was about up to the peak. And somebody was interviewing him in his book. He said, so the interviewer was asking, how much longer will it take you to work down the downstroke of the action potential? You know, think of a year doing differential equations. Isn't it crazy? Right? And so he said, I think I've got some calculus shortcuts, and I can maybe do it in 6 more months. Okay. All right. So pretty neat. So this explains the membrane potential going up and down like for your action potential because of the permeability of the ions and that concentration difference that's across there. And he was working out the voltage-gated channels at that time, which ones were opening, what ions are moving, okay? So pretty cool to think about what the history is that people had to go through to get this. Okay, so in your lab, you're actually doing this kind of graph. So here's the Nernst equation as you vary the potassium concentration, right? Increasing concentration, what happens to your resting membrane potential? It goes up. But why is it way down here at very low levels of potassium? It doesn't fit the Nernst equation of just potassium. And I know I said it earlier, but you might have like phased out because you don't have enough caffeine in you yet. What happens to the leak channels? Sodium can go through. So this is due to the permeability of sodium, and this is why the Goldman-Katz equation, Hodgkin-Katz equation, actually fits that line right perfectly well. Because at the low potassium, now we have sodium that's permeable. All right, and you work that out in your lab component. Okay, so that's really cool. Really neat. And you just think about the history that's gone into that. And what maintains all this? The pump, right? To keep these ions different. And we'll talk more about it later on. So you get an action potential. Voltage gated, sodium channels open up, boom, you get an action potential. And it goes up to some value. What's driving the sodium again? Why does sodium going into the cell? Two things. Electrochemical gradient, right? Chemical, higher on the outside, lower on the inside, so that's going that way. Electrical, too, it's negative inside the cell, so that's going in, right? So that's pretty cool to think about. All right, so let's think about something that might help you with this. And I know you're probably like crazy with my drawings already. All right, so the way to think about this is, and this isn't in your textbook, but I think this will help you. Let's look at the E potassium. And you know what E potassium stands for now, right? The equilibrium potential for the potassium. What did we calculate this at? Like minus 58 millivolts, right? Let's just say in our theoretical cell. What if we calculated E sodium? What's its value? Remember, sodium's higher on the outside. So if you went back to Nernst's equation, assumed permeability, put it in, got some values, it's going to be some plus value. Let's say in this particular example, it might be plus 55 millivolts. Wow. Here's 0 millivolts. At rest, what's the driving gradient for sodium? The electrical driving gradient. It's 58 plus 55, right? So 58 plus 55, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, right? 10, 11, right? 113 millivolts. Wow, that's a lot, right? As it goes to threshold, it's just a little ways up. Maybe it's at minus 50 or maybe minus 40. It could say minus 40. So it could subtract, you know, 18 from that, for example. But still, it's pretty high. So that means that sodium wants to go to the equilibrium potential. So when you open up this threshold right here of the voltage-gated sodium channels, what does the membrane want to go to if you have sodium channels open? It wants to go to the E-sodium, right? Why doesn't the peak of the action potential go to plus 55? Test question. Why does the action potential not go to the E-sodium? What's unique about the voltage-gated sodium channels?
Open and then they close immediately.
That's right. They're inactivated. They inactivate. They open and then they inactivate. So think of an ion channel closed. It's a protein. It changes its potential across their membrane. They open up. Ions go in, but that membrane keeps moving around. That protein keeps moving around and inactivates. It closes again. It's an inactive state, right? So it can't keep going through the membrane if the channel's closed. So it never reaches the E sodium. But what else happens on the upstroke of the action potential? That's right. Potassium channels open. So if we're at rest, what's the driving gradient for E potassium? Very little, right? But if these channels have unique makeup of amino acids, they sense the voltage at a different voltage. They sense the voltage up here somewhere. Let's call that maybe, you know, I drew it a little bit high, but it's somewhere up on the upstroke. And if the voltage-gated potassium channel is open, when it's far away from the E potassium, what's the driving gradient for potassium now? It's high. So if you open up the voltage-gated potassium channels, what's that going to do to your membrane potential? Want it to go back towards the E potassium, right? So it goes back towards the E potassium. All right, you get the idea? It's these. That's why the Nernst equation is really important to work out for E sodium, E potassium. So sometimes, what happens when you see it in your textbook, which is in med physiology textbooks, I don't know why they keep using it, the difference is that sometimes you see this action potential go below the resting membrane potential. Now let's fix this. In that case, that means that E potassium is lower. Let's say it's minus 70. And the RP might be here at minus 58, okay? Try to keep this straight. And so the RP, if the RP is at minus 58, and you had an action potential, and you got this undershoot, it's probably because at rest you're not at EK. You might have some leak of sodium, right? And what's going to happen with the some leak of sodium? It's going to be more towards the E sodium. So when you get this kind of case, the resting membrane potential being above, then if you have an action potential, it goes below. And this is why you have that downward hyperpolarization. So this is common in the squid axon. You're not a squid. Your cells are not squids, right? And so they show that in the textbook, still in like med physiology textbook, because that's the original description that was done in the squid axon. Many of your cells do not have a hyperpolarization below rest, all right? Because your E potassium is very close to the resting membrane potential. Okay, how could you hyperpolarize a cell from rest by not opening a potassium channel? Maybe another type of ion. Another ion. That could make it more negative. That's high on the outside. Chloride ion. So generally, an E chloride is lower than the resting membrane potential. So if you open up in your brain, you have receptors called GABA receptors, the most common inhibitory transmitter. Now, we shouldn't think of transmitters as excitatory and inhibitory. We should think of the receptors, right? But in general, GABA, it will bind to the receptor, open up a receptor that's a chloride channel. Chloride is high on the outside, and of course it's negative inside, so it doesn't want to go in down the electrical gradient, but it wants to go down that concentration gradient. Chloride will go into the cell and make it more negative. That's because the E chloride is down here below the resting membrane potential. So that's how you can inhibit a cell. You can make it more negative, and you can drive the electrical gradient to a lower potential. All right, that's how you can inhibit a particular cell. Test question on old exams. What if you activated a GABA receptor or an inhibitory motor neuron on a cell, and right here you activated it and you didn't see any change? It stayed at RP. What would you anticipate then? You've got to really think. The resting membrane potential is at the E chloride. So, this is really quite interesting. This means that the E chloride is right here too. But if you tried to depolarize the cell, let's say you have excitatory input on it, and you're depolarizing the cell before, let's say now let's go over here, you depolarize with some excitatory aspect, and then you gave GABA, what's going to happen to that depolarization? It's going to come right back down to rest, right? So this is how your brain's working all the time, right? You can inhibit the excitatory input by having a little bit of GABA that's released ahead of time. Now, what would happen if we had the GABA first and then the excitatory transmitter? We would probably short-circuit the whole thing, right? We wouldn't get the excitation because the chloride channels are open. So as soon as you try to depolarize, it's going right back to the E chloride. This is what was described in 1961 at the neuromuscular junction in the crayfish preparation. What's really interesting, and we're getting into synaptic transmission in the next chapter as well, is that in the invertebrates, you can have excitatory input to your skeletal muscles and inhibitory input to your skeletal muscles. You have only excitatory input to your skeletal muscles. And you use acetylcholine, right? And your receptors, we're going to get into that, are nicotinic receptors, like nicotine, right? And cigarettes. So those channels will open up and allow sodium to go in. We're going to cover that a little bit more in depth later. But at the crayfish neuromuscular junction, people were doing these works, Doodle and Kuffler. Doodle is another one of those gods, and Kuffler is another one of those gods. Kuffler was the chair of neurobiology at Harvard University for many years. So we're talking about Harvard Medical School neurobiology. He was the chair. He described so many things. One of the big preps that he worked on was the crayfish neuromuscular junction. And they were doing this work where they would stimulate the exciter, get depolarization. Stimulate the inhibitory motor nerve, wouldn't see anything. They were like, what on earth is this nerve doing then? But then they decided to do these nice experiments. Let's stimulate the inhibitor, then the exciter. Didn't get anything. to stimulate the exciter, get depolarization, then the inhibitor, and it would come right back down faster than it would normally if you just excited the exciter. So they described a lot of these properties back in the 1960s about inhibition and excitation. So Kuffler is one of these people that just played around with many different preparations. Actually, he taught many different people experimentation that they could then go on with. One thing is he showed potential electrical spikes in the occipital cortex. He gave that project on over to Ubel and Wiesel. Ubel and Wiesel got a Nobel Prize. He gave lots of projects on to his students, and they went off to win Nobel Prizes. But he didn't do it himself. He just wanted to give out information, help encourage the field. So he's really quite amazing, Stephen Kuffler. Okay, so that's that point. Now back to this, and then we'll quit yapping so much. All right. So why is it that you can stimulate an action potential, get a nice action potential, but if you stimulate the second one, it's abortive? That's that refractory period. The voltage-gated sodium channels have not recovered yet. All right? If you wait long enough, and you stimulate again, you can get another action potential. This is that voltage-gated sodium channels that haven't been able to get back to their resting state. And usually it takes them to get back to their resting state. What? It takes them to go back to the resting membrane potential before they can change their conformation again to be activated. So this is the absolute refractory period, this blue zone right here, whereas you cannot stimulate a second action potential, because these voltage-gated sodium channels are still in an inactive state. But if you wait, you can have abortive action potentials, smaller ones, and then finally get to the full-size action potential again if you wait long enough. And that's the time it takes to get the inactivation removed. So this is called the relative refractory period. These are test questions on MCAT types of exams, if you're interested. Okay, so it's all due to that voltage-gated sodium channel. Alright. And every cell is a little bit different. What makes some cells fire maybe a single action potential and other cells fire many action potentials? What could you maybe think of that might be different among these two cells? Maybe refractory period, but most likely they have similar types of sodium channels. There could be different isoforms. What brought the cell down? What brought that potential down initially? Chloride R in a normal active potential we're talking about, like squid stuff. Potassium, right? So maybe you have a whole bunch of voltage-gated potassium channels in one cell type compared to the other, so you can bring it down quickly and maybe get it back down to the resting membrane potential. Or maybe there's some chloride ions that brought it back down. There's lots of differences. The take-home of this is the density of the channels on the membrane makes the shape of the action potential. The density and type of channels. Open response question. Shape of the action potential is due to what? Density of the channels and the type of channels in the membrane. So let's think about if this was at the nerve terminal at your neuromuscular junction. Okay, at your neuromuscular junction. Let's just think. This is the nerve terminal to your neuromuscular junction. At the nerve terminal, what's different? We don't want to just conduct electricity down the axon. We want to do something. We want to have vesicles that fuse to the membrane and release their transmitter. But what causes the vesicle to fuse to the membrane? Calcium comes in. What's different at the nerve terminal is you have voltage-gated calcium channels. So now let's think about it. The E-calcium, calcium is very high outside compared to inside, so what do you think the E-calcium is? Is it going to be negative or positive? Like sodium? Positive value. And it might be as high as plus 120 millivolts. That is really high, right? So if you're at a low value, and all of a sudden you open up voltage-gated calcium channels, what does calcium want to do? You know, it wants to go to the E-calcium, so it's going to rush into that cell, load that cell up with calcium, and it causes the vesicles to fuse. So calcium's a 2 plus charge, right? What's going to happen to the shape of the action potential with the voltage-gated calcium channels maybe opening up in here? Is it going to become narrower? Or is it going to become wider? Is it going to change in the peak amplitude? What do you think is going to happen?
Wider.
And maybe bigger, right? Because E calcium is at a plus 120, right? And E sodium is only at plus 55. So it could be higher. We'd have to measure it, right, to really find out, you know. So here's the question. I give it every year. I've been teaching for 22 years. I started off at $25. It was $50. Last year it went to $75. Still no one's got it. I'm up at $100. I'll give you a $100 bill if you get this answer. If you can find the paper, because I'm still looking for it. Find a mammalian preparation. Mammals, you know mammals, sorry. Mammalian preparation where they've taken an intracellular electrode and measured in the motor nerve terminal, neuromuscular junction, the shape of the action potential. You get $100, you find the primary pair, send that, okay? Neuromuscular junction, motor nerve terminal, mammalian preparation. But you will see in med physiology textbooks showing you the shape of the action potential. Where is that shape coming from? Your favorite preparation is what again? I love it. So, are you a crayfish? No, we're like little crayfish stuff. The point is, by inference, right? By inference, we understand how we work by comparative physiology. But the direct measurements have not been made, as far as I know. Question?
Did you say
let me stop this echo. And the audio. I think it keeps